Hello, and welcome to the College of Education Lecture Series, where we bring you guest lectures, talks, and discussions on a variety of topics related to education, to teaching and learning, and to instructional technologies. Today's audio-only podcast is a mock debate on the education platforms of Barack Obama and John McCain. The debate was sponsored by the Educational Policy and Evaluation Center. Shaniqua Williams acted as moderator. Eric Houck represented John McCain's education platform, while Elizabeth DeBray-Pillow represents the platform of Barack Obama. All three individuals are faculty members in the Department of Lifelong Education, Administration, and Policy here in the UGA College of Education.
Good afternoon, and welcome to our mock educational debate for the presidential candidates, Senator John McCain and Senator Barack Obama. This activity that we're doing today is actually a nonpartisan effort, a service from the Educational Policy and Evaluation Center. We thought that it would be nice to offer this to the college, just to give you more of a basis of what the two candidates, what their platform is for education. As you've seen on the three debates that have actually occurred on television, a lot of times they have kind of skipped over education to some degree. And so we thought it would be nice to offer that to the college. Again, this is a nonpartisan effort. This is just our way of saying this is what the platforms are. The ideas represented here are not those of the individuals who are speaking. They are just representing the two presidential campaigns. Members are associated with the Education Policy and Evaluation Center. To my left, I have Dr. Elizabeth DeBray-Pillow, who is the Associate Director for Policy with the Education Policy and Evaluation Center. She's also an Associate Professor in the Department of Lifelong Education, Administration, and Policy. And her research interests revolve around desegregation and the general interests of politics of education. To my right is Dr. Eric Houck, who is a research fellow, policy research fellow with the Policy and Evaluation Center. He is also an assistant professor in the Department of Lifelong Education, Administration, and Policy, and he is also in the EDAP program, which is Educational Administration and Policy. I am Shaniqua Williams. I am an assistant professor in that same department, and I'm also a policy research and evaluation associate with the center. So, again, we thought that this would be a great exercise or a great activity to offer to you all. We have flyers with the courses that we offer, policy-related courses that we offer in the department, so we hope that you all will grab one of those just on your way out, just to show you the different types of policy courses that we offer over in EDAP. At this time, we're going to go ahead and begin with questions for the debate. We have about 40 minutes of questions to the faculty members here, and about 20 minutes for questions and answers from you all. The questions are timed. We have a timekeeper here who will let the two representatives know when their time is up to answer the questions. So if you could just hold all questions and applause one way or the other. I tried to say that with a straight face. until it's time for the question and answer session. I'm going to begin here with Eric Houck again, who is going to talk to us about the platform of the McCain camp. And the first question I'd like to ask is, tell us about McCain's platform, basically how his past experiences, his, you know, former experiences, his advisors help him form his educational policy stance, and also basically what is his governmental philosophy of education?
Good question. Well, thank you, and hello, good to see everybody here. So McCain has an interesting group of folks around him, and he comes from an interesting place. As you know, McCain's senator from Arizona. Arizona, since 1994, a little bit later, has been really big into the charter school movement. In fact, going just to dig through some, I'm not going to throw a lot of numbers at everybody, but these are just sort of thumbnail numbers. Almost 10% of all students in Arizona attend a charter school. 11% of all schools in Arizona are charter schools. So they're educating a lot of kids through charter programs. And even a left-leaning group like the Progressive Policy Institute, when they've done an analysis of charter schools in Arizona, have come to the conclusion that there are some pretty egregious problems with finance and management, but that overall approximately 45 to 50% of charter schools are performing quite well in Arizona. So I think that's important because it helps one to understand sort of where McCain's head is at when he thinks about what education reform and education policy looks like. As far as his team, if you're as much of a geek as Elizabeth and I are, you might have been at your computer last night at Teachers College, did what they call a webinar debate of advisors for each of the campaigns. McCain's main advisor is Lisa Graham Keegan, who was the chief executive of Arizona Schools for a lot of this the later 90s and this transition into charters. Also on his team, he has a number of folks, but the people that I thought were of note were Jane Swift, who is a former governor of Massachusetts. And Gene Hickok, who was an undersecretary of education in the first Bush administration. I'm not sure if he was in the second. I think he exited. So what you see with the team that McCain has around him is a group of folks who have some experience, mostly at state level education reform and governance. What Gene Hickok is bringing to the table is a little more of an understanding of what the Department of Education is capable of doing and how they're navigating it. So you have the Arizona piece. You have sort of this team of folks. I think the main thrust of the platform can be summed up pretty simply, probably a lot more simply for McCain than for Obama. I think McCain really sees a strong relationship between the concept of data and the concept of deregulation. And in fact uses data collection as a way to springboard into deregulation. I think he has a theme in his campaign of what he calls removing constraints and barriers from different subsystems within education overall. I think we're going to talk more about those as we go through the questions. I think a third sort of theme that runs through his education plank, his planks, are the use of market incentives to spur reform and reward innovation. And then I think as just a bottom line policy position that impacts not just education but everything else, he wants to freeze domestic spending. So I think what you hear a lot from his advisory team is going to be about efficiency, doing more with less, aligning the system, and capping domestic spending. How's that for time? Like, okay.
Thank you. Two elements I want to touch on about what's shaping the Obama campaign. First, I'll start with sort of the who's on the team. And two of the most prominent advisors right now are Linda Darling Hammond, a professor at Stanford University School of Education. And Linda Darling Hammond writes across a range of education policy issues. But kind of in the public domain, what she's best known for is in the debates over teacher preparation and recruitment retention, she's associated with what's been called the professionalism agenda, which is at the other end of the spectrum from the deregulation agenda. That is, that in debates over, you know, should there be alternative certification plans, should we regulate or deregulate the teaching profession, she's on the side of arguing that we need to do things like enhance career ladders, enhance the credentials for becoming a teacher and the routes into the profession. So that those themes have been emphasized in the campaign. The other advisor, whom I happen to know a lot about because he happened to be my boss for 4 years at the Civil Rights Project at Harvard, is Christopher Edley Jr. And the presence of him on the campaign tells us a lot about different issues we'll be talking about today. Christopher Edley Jr., despite his interest in civil rights law, was not a professor of civil rights policy at Harvard Law School. He was a professor of administrative law, which means that when he's thinking about governmental programs, if you're thinking about No Child Left Behind, Chris Edley's brain doesn't look at it and say, what a disaster for people at the ground level. Christopher Edley's brain is sort of about, wow, so we got this, how do you get laws onto the books that will shape agencies and shape people's access to rights? So that's an important thing to know about with him, is that while he works on civil rights issues, he comes at things from very much a regulatory kind of framework. So he was Obama's professor at Harvard Law School. He also has a background in the Carter and Clinton administrations. He was he wasn't in Clinton's cabinet, but he was an advisor on affirmative action. And he also, well, that's enough about Chris for now. The other thing that I need to say quickly about Obama is that he's been very much affected by his role in reform in the Chicago public schools. During the 1990s, those of you who've taken my classes know about the Annenberg Challenge Grant that Walter Annenberg gave to urban districts to reform schools. Obama served as the chairman of the Chicago Annenberg Challenge Board. So he oversaw $49 million that came in from the foundation, and then $98 million that was given as matching by Chicago nonprofits. And so during that time, he spent lots of time in the Chicago public schools. That was also a period of a lot of site-based management reforms in Chicago. So he's been very much influenced by looking at sort of school-by-school level change. So I think to kind of do what Dr. Haug did, to tie together a little bit of his shaping philosophy here, you can see the combination of an interest in grassroots level action with then more this administrative regulatory, how do we secure people's rights and make systemic change.
Okay, I'll begin with you for this next question, Dr. DeBray-Pillow. Both of the candidates articulate that the child is at the center of their approach to educational policy. Can you speak to us about what that means for the Obama campaign?
Yes. Well, I'll sort of pick up where I just left off, that when you think about Obama's governmental philosophy, there have been some interesting articles written about sort of Obamanomics. What's his philosophy of governing? And he spent about 10 years as a lecturer on the faculty at University of Chicago Law School. And most of you who have taken economics may know that there's sort of in economics a Chicago view or a Chicago school of thought in economics. And essentially, it's one that's very, very, has a lot of affinity for free markets, laissez-faire, faith in the ability of markets to correct problems over the long term. So some of the people who were close to him at that time characterized him as sort of a University of Chicago Democrat. That is, there's no doubt that his philosophy of government is liberal, but he has a lot of interest in the power of markets to regulate once a governmental intervention has been adopted. So a good example, one that I read about, is that his health care plan. Unlike Clinton, he really believes not in mandating coverage for all, but in making sure that the access is available and then kind of having faith that the uninsured will sign up. So that's one example. And in his philosophy of education, you can see it a little bit too, in that he, as I mentioned before, has some elements that want to deregulate, like doubling funding for charter schools from the federal level, but then he's not willing to abandon a lot of the federal regulatory structures. So I think his philosophy is sort of a combination of grassroots work and volunteerism, but also changing the regulatory structure. While he believes in the power of markets, it does not extend to the level of Senator McCain's philosophy.
Okay. Dr. Haug, for the McCain campaign, what does it mean when they say that the child is at the center?
So McCain should probably get an honorary degree from the Chicago School of Economics, right? I mean, his very market-based approach to what's going on. And I think when McCain and his campaign talk about the child, they talk about it in two ways. One, it is the unit of ultimate concern. And they frame education as an endeavor that's ultimately about the type of education that a child receives in school. And then the second way that I think they refer to the child is really the child being the proxy for the family. And I think these two ideas, when you put them together for the campaign, provide a very powerful rationale for what they're trying to do. I remember I was telling Dr. DeBray-Pillow before we started, when I first got to graduate school, it was 2003, and one of the professors in sort of a public forum somewhat like this mentioned something about No Child Left Behind being sort of the next round of civil rights legislation in our country. that was not received very well, right? What are you talking about? How, you know, this is like standards-based, it's very structured, this is not the same thing as ensuring civil rights. But that language is interesting, I've been interested in noting, has sort of percolated through some of the academic world and into the political world, and that's language that you find on the McCain website, in the text of a lot of the transcripts of a lot of his presentations. He speaks about stuff like No Child Left Behind and education reform in general as being a civil rights issue. And the way that he frames this by combining sort of the child as the unit of concern and the family as the unit of action is through, he uses these metaphors to drive towards some choice-based conclusions, right? So when he comes out and starts talking about education, he asks you to think about a child in a failing inner city school and then asks you to think about what those child's options are. Right. Certainly, he would argue, when he sets up kind of a straw man argument, there are systemic things that we can do, that we can improve that school over the course of 5 years. But he uses the child to sort of force the immediacy of the question. What can this child and this child's family do, you know, next week, next month, next year, to secure education and sort of all the economic and social derivatives that education brings? And that's how he gets us to the place of thinking about exit options for students in failing public schools. Right, that there's a charter option, there's a voucher option, and these are the things that he puts on the table. Yeah.
Could I take back 1 minute? Because I realized that instead of really answering the question of the child at the center, I sort of went into governmental philosophy. So just quickly.
I think that's what we do, though, right?
Yes, it is. But the way that Obama's advisor really talks about investing in children is kind of more building of a system of access to high quality education. And it's just worth stating the obvious that in contrast to McCain, Obama and his administration would really be much more sympathetic to the idea of expanding funding traditional categorical programs. So,
yeah, I think that's right. And I think sort of the place to locate the discussion, there's an old piece written in the 1970s by Coons and Sugarman, and it's this really concept that sort of keeps coming back around when you talk about market-based reform in education or any of those types of policy movements. And what Coons and Sugarman called it is the family professional dispute. And this is not something that they advocated for or against. This is really a dynamic that they just identified, right? And it goes something like this. Hey, you know, in a civil society, you have two groups of people who are really interested in the welfare of kids, usually. Theoretically. One is the family, right, who wants to do right by their children. And the second are education professionals who are in schools and want to do right by kids as well. And what Coons and Sugarman ask us to consider is that there are some times when those two groups, both interested in the same kid, will come into direct conflict with one another. Right. So when you talk about an educational professional having the best interest of a particular child in mind, they might reach very different conclusions about what to do than a family would who are ultimately concerned in the same way about the same kid. And I think, not to advocate or anything, but I think that's just an interesting tension that Coons and Sugarman left us with. And it's, 30, 40 years later, we're still thinking about that dynamic.
Dr. Hawk, I'd like to go back. You touched on No Child Left Behind a little bit. And we understand that under the next administration that No Child Left Behind will have to be reauthorized. Could you speak to us about what changes, if any, a McCain administration would make to No Child Left Behind concerning funding, assessments, and sanctions to individual schools and districts?
So McCain's a huge fan, speaks about being a huge fan of No Child Left Behind now. I didn't even look up to see if he voted for it. I don't know. Do you know?
He did.
Okay. But there are a number of changes that he's talked about, sort of specific, wonky policy proposals. One of the things I want to go ahead and say right now, but then come back around to later, is basically No Child Left Behind, it runs through these titles, right? So Title I is funding for economically disadvantaged. Title II is teacher prep, professional development stuff. One of the things McCain wants to do or proposes doing is really just melting away Title II entirely. And when we get to talk about teachers, I can talk about where he wants to put all that money. But really, so Title II, the federal hand in doing anything about teacher professional development really ceases to exist in the way that we think about it now, which I thought was pretty amazing, equally amazing that nobody's talking about it, which made me think that maybe I was wrong, because I'm not the brightest bulb all the time. But other things that he wants to do come around to this idea of immediacy. So, for example, now under No Child Left Behind, a school that doesn't make adequate yearly progress, there's a year one, and then there's a year two, and I think by year three, there's finally sanctions. I look over, Dr. DeBray-Pillow wrote a whole book on this stuff, so she really is kind of the expert in the room on a lot of these things. But what McCain wants to do is really shorten that timeline for sanctions. So basically, if your school fails in year one, you're eligible for supplemental educational services and tutoring services sort of right out of the gates. Right, rather than just having a year of warning or a year to kind of climb back or a year to think about safe harbor, you don't really have any of that. You're just directly into what folks call the sanctions of No Child Left Behind. There's no margin of error for messing up or for the test being wrong or your student population to change any of that. The other thing he wants to do that I think is an interesting policy piece is really change how this the money for supplemental education services works its way through the system. And I think what John McCain is using as his model really is a higher education model. All right. So in 1972, the federal government completely changed the way that student loans work. See, student loans. See how I'm kind of making the connection for everybody here? used to be student loans ran through the institution and then was distributed to the student. And in 1972, that paradigm changed. And it's actually somewhat of a voucher program. You apply directly for student loans. The money, the check, comes to you, and then you spend it at the...
Does everyone know what SES is?
Supplemental Education Services, or what SES is. Thank you.
Does everyone know what that is?
I don't know.
Does everyone know what Supplemental Educational Services are? That you can take your Title I allocation out of a non-high-performing school to a private tutor. Mm-hmm. Highly controversial
right.
idea for Democrats.
Yes. So what McCain wants to do with this is actually change the paradigm around SES, where companies would be certified by the federal government, money would go directly to the student or the family, who could then basically purchase services from an approved list of SES providers, rather than having the SES provider contract directly with the school and provide services for all the kids in that school. So that's a couple of the big things. We can talk about testing if we want to, but McCain pretty much wants to keep things the way they are, and I think I'm out of time. We'll talk about Title II in a couple minutes.
So, sort of hearkening back to what I was saying about his advisors, Obama also does not want to change the major framework for No Child Left Behind. So he does not want to repeal it or its goals. Themes that the campaign has emphasized first of all, I should say that neither campaign has been highly specific about what they will and will not do.
That's true.
So I think that if there's an issue we're talking about today where the campaigns have been least committal, it's probably this one. Because one thing that Dr. Houck didn't mention is that, you know, within Congress, McCain will be susceptible to a lot of pressure from members of his own party who actually do want to abolish the whole thing. Because remember, 3/4 of the no votes on No Child Left Behind were conservative Republicans. Have never liked it. All right, so, but Obama does not want to repeal the Act's goals. What he wants to do is to improve the quality of assessments. He's given several speeches where he says, we don't want students and teachers dedicating large parts of the school year to bubble tests, low-level assessments, which have, in fact, become kind of the de facto curriculum, particularly in a lot of schools that Title I is intended to assist. So just yesterday, there was sort of a little back and forth in the media about this because some advisor to Obama said, well, we want to include portfolio assessment as part of how students would be assessed under the federal law. And it was picked up by the McCain campaign, and it came up in the debate, the advisors' debate last night. Oh, so you want to scrap mainstream testing, which would provide us a basis of comparison, and go to portfolios. So the advice of the campaign has said no. The truth is in between. We think that there should be some more open-ended kinds of assessments included. And in particular, last night, Linda Darling-Hammond said, you know, this is really more commonplace in the highest performing countries, that you want to be able to assess higher order thinking skills. Obama, like I think McCain, wants to make the adequate yearly progress in the accountability system far more based on a growth model as opposed to just sort of panel data. Well, no, it's just whatever, series data. So that you're really, in theory, holding schools accountable for the academic content that's been taught and learned in that year with that particular group of students. Haven't heard anything from him in terms of tightening the timeline for intervention in schools not making AYP. In fact, I think that probably the question that the Obama campaign would ask is, Senator McCain, how would state departments of education, which are already way, way strapped for capacity building funds for Title I schools, possibly do this, you know, in 2010, especially when the list of identified schools is going to be really huge. So Obama has said less emphasis on punishment and more support, more on support to improve. I personally haven't heard anything, any analysis down to the level of the choice measures or the SES. I haven't heard any call from the campaign to change any of those particular interventions.
I thought it was interesting last night, just to tack on one point, when you're talking about testing, so this whole issue of like portfolio assessments did kind of crop up at the debate. And Lisa Graham Keegan, who is no shrinking violet, right, and actually at a couple of times last night was sort of making more political points than sort of academic points. It was kind of interesting. Rather than really taking the opportunity to talk about that and hitting back hard, sort of came away with something like, well, it doesn't really matter what kind of assessment you have. Here's our ground level expectations for what assessments do, which I thought sort of, I mean, you know, we do policy stuff all the time, so maybe we get a little conspiratorial, but it seemed to me like it was a little bit of a campaign walk back to say, okay, yeah, testing, assessment, you know, research into that and reform of that would be okay. We're just going to put down some, you know, bedrock principles that we want to not deviate from. And really all they're really concerned about in that framework was what she called comparability. Right, the ability to see how students, schools, and perhaps even teachers are doing relative to other students, schools, and teachers.
And one thing we might come back to later is just cost, because one thing that that policy analysts note is the number of billions of dollars that states have sunk into complying with this universal 3-8 testing. So that's just a footnote. For anyone who would overthrow the basic structure may have to deal with a lot of state officials who actually have a lot invested in it. So,
excellent. Let's talk about teachers a minute, and I'll begin with you, Dr. DeBray-Pelot. We understand that No Child Left Behind, you know, mandates that schools have highly qualified teachers. Talk to us a bit about what the Obama campaign plans to do about recruiting, recruiting, rewarding, retaining highly qualified teachers.
So this is an area of major emphasis. In fact, it may be the most detailed component if you look at all of his plan. And again, you can really see Dr. Darling Hammond's thumbprints here. In terms of recruitment, the Obama campaign has written that nearly all of the vacancies currently filled with emergency teachers in this country could be filled with talented, well-prepared teachers if there were 40,000 service scholarships of up to $25,000 each. So the way that this would work, this is called teaching service scholarships for high need areas or high need subjects. So again, up to $40,000 service scholarships of up to $25,000 each. So basically, we'll pay for 4 years of your undergraduate teacher education or 2 years of graduate teacher education or a high quality alternative program for anybody, but especially mid-career recruits, in exchange for you serving 4 years in a high-need field or location. And mathematics and science are highlighted as very, very high-need areas in these proposals. So we're talking about a commitment to put a lot of money into recruitment. In terms of retention, again, there's a large list of different things that Obama would invest in here. They want to put $100 million into professional development schools, which many of you may know is a model that's fairly costly. That's why a lot of colleges of education don't do them, so that instead of placing candidates just throughout school systems, you have a school where professional development and mentorship are kind of the business of the professionals in that school. Obama proposes a nationally available teacher performance assessment that would require evidence of teacher outcomes in promoting student learning. And then here are a few things that sound like other countries. Mentoring and paid common planning time in schools. I thought that was very, very interesting. In terms of the problem that's being addressed here, the campaign is always emphasizing that 30% of new teachers in urban districts leave within 5 years. They also want to, Obama also proposes teacher residency programs in high-need areas that new teachers would receive a salary for a year-long residency training program. It sounds like a medical internship, which is paid back through a three-year service requirement in the district. And again, Chicago, apparently he's been really, am I out of time? Okay, so we didn't talk about rewards, but basically Obama wants to offer federal financing for districts adopting pay-for-performance plans. But more commonly, what's discussed is the Career Ladder Initiative, which is an opportunity for high-achieving veteran teachers to gain additional compensation for serving as mentors and leading curriculum planning, professional development, and school reform efforts. A lot of money and programs here.
I think this is one of the places you can see the most daylight between the governing philosophies of the two candidates. Because McCain talks a lot about money, and there's percentages and there's dollars attached to things, but really you can really see that kind of behind these initiatives is the idea that there's a market at work, right? If we incentivize the system the right way, the change will drive itself. And I think what you hear from you is a lot of capacity building, you know, and exploration of different things. So it's just kind of an interesting point of contention. So one thing that I thought was really interesting last night when Lisa Graham Keegan was talking about teacher salaries, the question asked of both the advisors was, does money matter? Will more money matter? And should we increase federal funding for education? Now, of course, McCain has an anvil around his neck because he's freezing domestic spending, so what are you going to say? One of the things that she mentioned, she said, you know, basically alluding to the fact that there is enough money in the system, it's just not going to the right places. And one of the things that she used to describe is that the United States is one of the highest spending countries in administrative salaries, one of the lowest spending countries in teacher salaries. That we just have this relationship between administrator and teacher upside down. So it's not more money, it would just be altering the flow of money. I don't know, I haven't looked it up, but it would be interesting for a research topic for somebody to go check that out. So let's talk about what John McCain wants to do with Title II. We're talking about approximately $3 billion when I was looking at the, I guess a couple years ago, old numbers. And I said that basically McCain wants to melt that title away and do some other things with it. So what does he want to do? Well, 5% of that $3 billion he wants to take as a recruiting tool, right? And what he said he wants to do is to recruit students in the top 25% of their graduating classes from prestigious colleges and universities. Again, not a lot of detail about exactly what that would look like, but you can see that the kind of mental map I think that they're going for here is something like a Teach for America program where you concentrate recruitment on students who have already proven in college that they're very talented, and then you pull them away from whatever it is they would be doing otherwise and put them into an educational setting. 60% of the Title II funds are designated for a number of teacher pay initiatives. And it's a little infuriating for someone who does policy to sort of hear everything lumped together, right? Because basically it's sort of combat pay, hard-to-teach subjects, and performance-based. Three totally different things. So part of it is combat pay is probably an impolite term to say that there are bonuses for teachers who go to hard-to-teach schools in inner city cores or schools are persistently failing, that teachers would be incentivized to go to teach to those schools. And sometimes in the shorthand, we call that combat pay. The second thing would be to looking at hard-to-teach areas, math and science, special ed. These areas would be paid differently or incentivized to pay teachers differently than teachers in other subject areas, right? So you're really kind of coming up on that bugaboo of the single salary schedule, right? That all teachers, all subjects, essentially paid the same. You get, as they say, a bump and a step every year, right? You get a degree, you get more money, you get an extra year of experience, you get more money. And so this is sort of looking to break those relationships. And then finally, they talk about performance-based. But they talk about it in a number of different ways, and there are a number of different ways to do performance-based. So they're really silent or agnostic on exactly what that would be. But that's $1.8 billion of the $3 billion. And my time's up, and there's 35% of the money left, so what are you going to do? The remaining 35% is designated for something they call principals to basically use at the school level. So again, the operating metaphor here is almost like Jeffersonian democracy, right? The person closest to the action is best equipped to know what to do. And this 35% of Title II funds would go directly to principals for staff professional development, other types of reward systems that the principals would devise. So I think a really good follow-up question would be, what level of faith and confidence do we have as policy people in our principals to use that money wisely, and what does research tell us about what principals do when they trip over $35 million in the middle of an election year?
Another quick footnote is that you have to remember that, unlike the past, either candidate is not going to make the teachers' unions terribly happy
with their embrace
of merit pay. Mm-hmm. Just something we can come back to later when we talk about Congress, too.
Okay. And McCain people love Teach for America. Love, love, love it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Talk about more about that later too.
We've so far we've discussed basically K-12 issues. Let's talk a little bit about early childhood, and I'll begin with you, Dr. Houck. What exactly does the McCain campaign hope to do with the issues of early childhood education? Do they have a plan for funding, more or less? Could you talk to us about that?
I sure can. Well, they're freezing domestic spending, so no. That was easy. You want all 6 minutes? I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
I know Obama has a lot to say about early childhood, and the McCain platform is has relatively less to say. Again, what they're coming out with is And a lot of some of Lisa Graham Keegan's early work was in literacy and in pre-K, early childhood stuff, or at least this is what she talks about when she talks about formational experiences of her professional life. What they note, and probably overstate a little bit, is that the process for funding in early childhood is convoluted. That there's a lot of streams of funding coming from a lot of different agencies with different rules and regulations that sometimes overlap, conflict, or bump into one another. So one of the things they're putting a lot of hope on, sorry to take a word from the Obama campaign.
And Clinton.
I'll be here all week. Yeah, exactly, from a little town in Arkansas. Is they really believe they're going to pick up savings on efficiencies from streamlining the system, right? They really want to have a system where the federal government can talk to the county health department, where children, again, the center of the theory of action here, and families can get their needs met through an integrated approach to providing multiple services. And they just have a tremendous amount of confidence that that's going to generate some savings that they can plow back into early childhood. Just anecdotally, when I had a real job and worked in a school system, I came into my job when we were working on doing this with the county health department, and I left my job as we were working on this with the county health department. The technical requirements to get your databases to talk to one another, confidentiality agreements and legal agreements was really intense. So I think, speaking from a firsthand perspective, I think that's a tremendous challenge the McCain campaign's laid out. So there's that. The other thing that they want to do is to pull back some money that's going into early childhood now from the federal government and create what they call centers of excellence. Basically, $200,000 chunks of money that would identify lighthouse or early childhood programs. The idea, I think, probably Dr. Brayblow can talk about it a little bit more from the federal perspective, is identifying high-performing early childhood programs with the hope that once people see what's identified as a highly effective program, people will attempt to replicate it and thereby sort of drive innovation across the plane, right? 1,000 points of light kind of thing from the Bush administration. I know the first Bush administration, they talked about lighthouse schools in a similar way, that if you identified schools or organizations that are high performing, people will stand up, take notice, and begin to try to figure out what makes these organizations tick. That's really the two things. Oh, there's one more thing. Yep. Sorry. It's all about language and literacy. So the programmatic curricular shift would go really towards much greater emphasis on language and literacy skills in early childhood. I think there's plenty of research on that. Sorry.
So again, I think this is an area where the two campaigns, where the philosophies you could see diverge markedly, because University of Chicago or not, here's where you see the differences between the two parties, because this is, the Obama administration is proposing to spend $10 billion a year on early childhood education, or nearly a third of the whole education budget. One of his advisors I didn't mention before, who's commented on his plans, is James Heckman, an economist at University of Chicago, won a Nobel Prize in Human Capital Theory at age 30 or something, maybe younger. And what Heckman has really written about is the investment quality. When you put in a dollar, a federal dollar spent on a child between 0 and 5, whether it's in Head Start or other kinds of pre-K programs, is going to pay off huge dividends in terms of the criminal justice system, special education identification. It goes on and on. So Obama wants to expand access to Head Start. See, with any federal program, what you have to remember is that only a small portion, usually between 30% and 40%, of the eligible children are served. Title I does not serve every poor kid in this country. It serves about a third. So same with Head Start. In the debate last night, Obama's advisor claimed that with all of the programs they want to do, you would get close to universal access with Head Start. So what they're talking about is going from serving about 40% of eligible children, 400,000 a year, to 1 million. Trying to also make investments in improving the quality of teaching in Head Start. This is another area where there's a lot of rhetorical sharpness between the candidates, and this was in the debate last night between the advisors. You know, Lisa Graham Keegan and a lot of other members of the campaign often say, well, what have we gotten from Head Start? You know, we've put all of this in, but the gains fade by the time they're in third grade. And Linda Darling Hammond gave what I think has been academics' reply to this charge for a long time. Well, that doesn't make Head Start a failure. The fact that you might start to see some fading around third grade might be due to the fact that a lot of these kids go into high-poverty elementary schools. And we know that concentration of poverty is and neighborhood poverty are pretty highly associated with lower achievement levels. So to kind of tag that onto a federal program, Linda Darling Hammond and other Democrats think is a poor analysis. Many of you know that over the past 10 years, states, including this one, have been investing a lot more in pre-K. In fact, in many places, it's just becoming an institutionalized part of the public school system, much the way kindergarten was in the last century. So Obama would want to build on that momentum and give incentive grants to states to expand pre-K, and also continue things like child care incentive grants to families. There's also some interesting debate last night between the two advisors about testing. Graham Keegan at one point said to Darling Hammond, so you don't really believe in testing and being able to evaluate Head Start. And Darling Hammond came back and said, well, she didn't say, no, we don't. But she said, I think that most experts in the field would tell us that there are ways to assess programmatic quality without having a four-year-old sit down and have to fill in a paper and pencil test. I mean, she added, I thought, a lot of sophistication to this discussion.
A subtext from the Obama piece is they do talk a lot about wanting comprehensive national, not federal, standards and practices for early childhood programs.
Obama does, yeah.
McCain does too. But then they sort of slide into this more rigorous idea about standards and sort of conflate it with what happens in public education, which is, you know, a 1 cent per administration standardized thing.
Yeah. In terms of these lighthouse centers, I mean, Obama would come right back and say, why not put that into covering more kids in Head Start? Again, it's the theories, the theory of deregulation and holding up examples rather than trying to fund programs more.
Let's go on to our last question before we open it up to the audience. And let's talk about the role of Congress a little bit with both of these administrations and whether or not it will be business as usual. And let me hear first from what you think the Obama camp will do as far as what the role of Congress will look like in that administration.
Well, I can't claim to have looked at the websites in the past couple of days. But I think that it's fair to say that the projections right now at the Senate will have a very strong Democratic majority. I think the House will also be under Democratic control, though I can't say exactly by what margin that's projected. I think that one of the interesting things about Obama is that he's sort of what the pundits have called postpartisan. I mean, a lot of his campaign has been, let's try to find solutions that rise above partisan politics. And I think that I think it's an interesting conversation about what that means. I know that on the face of that, I personally am a skeptic, having studied education policy in Congress, because when I was studying it, partisanship couldn't have been any more rancorous and divisive. However, if the Democratic margins are as strong as it's projected, then we may not really ever know whether he's a postpartisan or not, because the majority of what he proposes may get passed by his own party. So I guess I'm talking more from sort of an academic perspective. I think it'd be very interesting to know how that will work. He's still going to have to deal on some level with the conservative Republicans who don't like No Child Left Behind. And, you know, the other thing about Congress is the budget. You know, the Obama education plan is $28 million a year. His plan states different ways that the savings in the federal budget can be achieved to do this. However, these documents were also drawn up before the $3 or $4 trillion bailout that was just passed. So one of the things I think we'll see with Congress is that whereas in the past the partisan debate has sort of been programs versus no new programs, very polarized, all of a sudden everybody may have to come into this kind of agreement. It won't be a debate between programs or no new programs, but between what part of the budget are we going to kind of rearrange and fold into a new program. So I think Congress is pretty constrained, and what the budgetary constraints really do to ideology, I think, is incredibly interesting. And then I would throw in this other point about the unions. You know, political science theory would tell us that when you have a Democratic majority in Congress, well, the unions should be able to get a little bit more of the clout that they had lost when the Republicans held the White House. But see, I don't know if that's true. I think this is a question for those of you who are interested in politics to try to answer. I think that they're never going to quite regain the same insider in-group status that they had.
That's fascinating. She literally did write an entire book about
it's for sale,
Congress.
Too.
Yeah, exactly.
Just ask my husband.
I get 5% if you buy it now, I'll get a cut for...
I write the title.
Exactly. I'm going to put it on the board. So
the McCain campaign has been very interesting to watch, basically because... without getting too much into political theory and what's going on, you see some evidence that McCain's been running to his right rather than exactly running to the middle in the campaign. So you're left with, similarly, like with Obama, you're asking, is he really postpartisan, or was that, you know, sort of the booster rocket that got him into the White House if he wins? For McCain, it's going to be, you know, are we talking about the 2000 to 2004 McCain? You know, I mean, if your political memory goes back that far, this is McCain who was part of the Gang of 14 that brokered a compromise on judicial appointments that then Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist was just absolutely furious about. You know, this is the McCain who voted against the Bush tax cuts. So there is sort of that word maverick has sort of, you know, some definition to it if you go back. From 4000 on, though, McCain has steadily moved his positions and his politics over to the right, and so you're kind of wondering, were he to come into office, and I think Dr. DeBray-Pelot is right about the projections for the Democrats holding, if not gaining, in the Senate and gaining in the House as well. So which McCain would be inaugurated, right? And then which McCain would sort of begin governing, particularly around a whole bunch of issues, not just education. So there is something in the McCain historiography that does know how to work with Democrats and has done it before. And I think the same question then, what kind of policy initiatives come out of that collaboration? You know, it might give McCain the cover he needs to be the centrist he's always, the right centrist he's always been, without getting too harshed on too bad from his further right base. He could, I think if he does win, he's going to win on a base strategy, and I think he's going to be beholden to some pretty powerful interests who are probably to the right of where he is politically, mm-hmm. and may need to satisfy those interests, because they're, I mean, I think looking at the numbers now, if he gets in the White House, they're going to be the people who brought him there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say...
I get a little rambly about the politics stuff.
You all can eventually come back and tell me I was wrong, but I think it's a very, very safe political statement to say that we're not going to have federally funded vouchers in this country in the next 4 years, unless it's continuing the D.C. or the Katrina aid targeted programs. You're not going to see it enacted as part of No Child Left Behind. I mean, this is true. See, even if you have narrow Democratic majorities in Congress, you're not going to see that happen because moderate Republicans who represent the suburbs, I mean, the people representing Oconee County, are not going to vote for it either. Why? Because they have excellent, well-funded public schools. They don't particularly want to be on either the receiving end or the exiting end. So, but if you're talking about large Democratic majorities in the Senate and the House, that's gone. As it was gone when Bush came in and proposed it. So not on the table, I don't think.
I think that just the one of our final points. I was rather disappointing in the third debate with Bob Schieffer when the education as an issue did come up. The thing that the candidates ended up haggling about is the DC voucher program, which, you know, I mean, really, you're just not talking about that many kids, and you're not talking about anything you can scale up nationally. It's a program in a specific place doing a specific thing, and the fact that that's kind of what passed for our debate on federal education policy was, in technical terms, a real bummer.
Right. And then the candidates perennially have to answer the question, well, isn't it kind of hypocritical that you send your own children to private schools, but you don't support this for all kids?
Right.
And, I mean, you know, the Clintons got that. And
yeah, that was Lisa Graham. That was her lead, her lead elbow last night in the debate.
Yep. What was the other aspect of Congress I was going to mention? One thing maybe what we could do right now is sort of a quick catch-all for things we wanted to say but didn't get to say. One thing I wanted to say is that when we were talking about different philosophies of the candidates, you definitely hear McCain, it's not as though he avoids the civil rights community. I mean, he attends, he's been to the NAACP, he's been, I guess, to MALDEF. But there's a very big difference, I think, in how they see themselves addressing civil rights issues. I think for McCain, you know, it's covered in a lot of what Eric has said, that choice is viewed and has been constructed as the new civil right, that minority communities, in many cases, there's higher demand for vouchers than there is in suburban communities. But coming back to the Chris Edley theme about administration, if Obama wins the election, you're going to see a huge reinvigoration of the cabinet level office and regulatory level emphasis on civil rights enforcement. It's been lying dormant for the past 8 years. In this administration, you're going to see a whole new set of administrative activities within Office of Civil Rights within Education, Office of Civil Rights within Department of Justice. This whole community is waiting in the wings to get back into the game in a very, very big way. And I don't know if Edley is going to serve in the cabinet. Probably not, because he's now dean at Berkeley of the law school. But that, I think, is also something in education that would have new life breathed into it.
If you have just a few minutes so that we can open it up.
Oh, sure, I do. I had four unrelated things that I'd meant to put out there. So one is this trivia that Arizona has a tuition tax credit law, which is one of the things that Georgia's considering now.
We have it.
Is it? It's real now. So basically, you can provide money to a nonprofit, and then flips around and gives that money to students to attend private schools on scholarship, and the money that you give is a tax credit. So that's sort of, again, where he's coming from in the Arizona context. The other thing I think the Arizona context has done is Senator McCain, throughout his political history and somewhat in the campaign, does have a pretty strong commitment to English language learner populations. You know, the fact that he bucked his party on immigration before the campaign got cranked up, and because of high numbers, higher percentages of ELL students in Arizona, he does seem to always have a commitment for fully funding those programs, or at least speaks about doing it. Let's see. I would just go back to say one more time, I think that the McCain folks, even if they don't know it, so it's a little political psychoanalysis, are very enamored of the 1972 Higher Education Act. And I think that if you really are trying to understand where they want to go with some ideas about portability and markets and all that kind of thing, a lot of whiffs of that legislation sort of come through when you're reading the stuff that comes from the McCain campaign. And then the other thing that is, we just didn't have time to talk about, but Sarah Palin really has done some interesting things with education funding in Alaska. Nobody ever talks about this, right? I mean, Alaska had a school funding lawsuit. They also had tremendous oil revenues. So what you see, and we didn't talk about the down ticket at all, and there's a lot of other things that people are talking about Sarah Palin. But one of the things that, as governor of Alaska, she has really had her hand in, I mean, one of the things she might actually have some direct experience to talk about is education funding and education policy. She increased the education budget in Alaska by $14 million, mostly on the backs of oil revenues, and sort of came into office at the tail end of Alaska's school funding litigation. So it's sort of interesting because people say, oh, she has all this experience in doing things that seem a little dubious to me personally, but nobody talks about school finance or school policy, which is something that she's really actually done a little bit more than your average governor about.
Maybe she could be Obama's secretary.
Discuss amongst yourselves. Right. Maybe she'd take a demotion and serve as, or maybe she'd have a twofer. She'd be vice president.
We didn't talk about secretaries either.
We didn't talk about secretaries at all. That's another interesting question. Maybe if we give somebody out there $5, they'll ask about secretaries of education.
Any questions from the audience?
So concerning No Child Left Behind, and you talked so much about, you know, the assessment piece, so have either candidates or any of their advisors talked about measuring growth? You know, we talked about it in the year.
Yeah.
Both. And so how would that happen?
Longitudinal data.
Yeah, so there's value added and then there's growth, and those two things get conflated a lot. I think and again, kind of stepping away from just presenting the McCain platform, and maybe it's true for both platforms, but I spent the last week sort of in McCain world. They're very loose about conflating those two terms. So they definitely talk a lot about value added. But that's a little bit different technically than what an actual straight-up growth model is. So they both say they support it, but I'm not sure, at least from the McCain side, I'm not sure they understand everything that's involved, right? So Georgia would like to do a value-added model too. That's basically where instead of judging a student, a class or a school based on did they get over this hurdle we call adequate yearly progress, you start taking into account, did the kids learn anything? It's a radical notion, I know. I come from North Carolina where schools are awarded on growth and performance level. So there's really two different assessments going on. You know, did you get to the hurdle you need to be at, and are kids in your school learning? But what that takes is an assessment system that looks very different for a lot of states and a data management system that looks really different for a lot of states and takes tremendous investment. So you look at a state that's actually doing it, which would be Tennessee. They have a test called the Tennessee Value Added Assessment System, which is basically learning for students in Tennessee on this test is vertically scaled so that you're kind of learning, you know, a bunch about a topic irrespective of your grade level, so you can kind of, like a thermometer, you know, a lot of tests are like a thermometer. You can only go up so high and then it's like, we don't know if you learned anymore or not because you're performing so well. And this test has a very high ceiling. But even now, folks at Vanderbilt have been doing research looking at the Tennessee Value Added Assessment and say that you know, you make some assumptions about these test items that just aren't true. So as much as it's scary to say, I think if you're going to do testing, you really need to get some very wonky person involved who can talk about these testing properties, because I think one of the lessons coming out of Tennessee yet again, and we thought for a long time that Tennessee had a great growth model, but you know, policymakers make assumptions that the tests can't carry. I don't mean to get too technical. That was probably too technical right there. I could get more technical, but I won't.
In fact, that's a good segue. Listening to him speak, I remembered that if you haven't already picked one up, our ABLE assistant, Mika Mohammed, pulled together a kind of a catalog of all of the courses that are taught in our department on policy and politics, including all of the doctoral level core courses. And all of you are hereby invited to come study with us and hear much, much more.
That's good.
And we don't stop at 3 minutes.
Right.
3 hours.
Shortest
three
summer
hours.
Ever.
I thought I saw another hand raised for a question.
Well, I want to know who's the new Secretary of Education.
Oh, good.
You get $5.
I think if McCain wins the election, it's very, very safe bet that Lisa Graham can.
I think, what do they say on ESPN? It's like a lead pipe lock. I mean, it's, yeah, she's been completely present. And it's funny, in doing research for this, there have been maybe three or four education policy debates. And in every education policy debate, there's been a different Obama person there. Mm-hmm. But it's always been Lisa Graham Keegan. She is sort of the voice of the education policy platform for the campaign. And she has experience at the state level, so I think it would be an easy sell for McCain to come into office that she would move into that position.
This is maybe the point where I'm trying to stay in character, but so I don't know. It's possible that Linda Darling-Hammond would become the Secretary of Education. I think if the campaign thinks about it, they might choose a governor instead. Right. I think that's always a smarter choice, probably, than an academic. I'm giving an opinion at this point, but you've got to deal with Congress and have credibility in Congress. And I've seen a couple of academics at the federal level get raked over the coals something fierce by members of Congress. So at one point, you had told me that former Governor Jim Hunt of North Carolina,
I heard his name
been out there
about
in the ether.
Yeah. Yeah. Now he's getting up there. So.
Right. It's not as though Secretary Riley has been the only effective U.S. education secretary, but he had the most longevity, and he was in there for 8 years. And I think that choosing someone who's been an executive at a state level, whether a governor or a chief, is a really good move in terms of working with Congress. But maybe it'll be Linda Darling-Hammond. I don't know. I would see him putting her in charge if he gets the appointment authority for the Institute of Education Sciences. That person just left, and I don't know if Bush is going to get the appointment. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. It seems to be the safest bet is to pick somebody with executive experience from South Mason-Dixon Line State.
Yeah.
Right? You've had Riley, and then Page, who was a superintendent, not a chief. And there's certain states that politically sort of have approved reform efforts and reform cachet. Mm-hmm. And so usually that sort of limits your target of opportunity as well.
In fact, our state is one of the only ones where the legislature hasn't passed some sort of a resolution against NCLB or demanding that there be a study about the underfunding of it. So Georgia is actually a state that's been really pretty popular with the Bush administration.
That would be interesting. So, but if it does happen that way, then everybody should dust off your resume, right? Because when you get a Secretary of Education from your home state, that, you know.
He might pick Paul Vallis.
Check your politics at the door and get a resume in, because that's a great way to get some really good experience.
What about Paul Vallis? I was thinking back to the Chicago connection, that maybe there was a team that was put in place by the mayor of Chicago in the 1990s to oversee the decentralization, and Paul Vallis was a businessman who was part of that team. Went on to be superintendent in Philadelphia, is now superintendent in New Orleans.
New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. He might. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard that name floated, but.
Now, do you think the Obama campaign would try to reconstitute some of the Clinton administration's
folks? That's a great question. Probably.
Marshall Smith doing another round as something other than what he was?
I think that Darling-Hammond might be put into the Smith position of undersecretary.
Uh-huh.
Those of you who remember the Clinton administration, remember former governor of Vermont, Madeline Cunin, was put in there as a deputy.
Mm-hmm.
So the academics might fill that right under the secretary level and run things. Smith, I think, is retired. I doubt he'd be back, but I do think so. I think the choice of Ed Lee shows it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah.
How are we doing with time, Mika?
It is time.
Well, if there are no, are there any other burning questions before we dismiss? Thank you all so much
for
coming.
The COE Lecture Series is produced by the Office of Information Technology in the UGA College of Education. Today's episode is copyright 2008, the University of Georgia.